Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hi, everybody. Here's a political struggle you might not have expected to hear between the conservative, deep-pocketed Koch brothers and a think tank they've been funding for decades. The think tank is the Cato Institute. Cato Vice President and co-founder David Bowes joins us now. David, thank you for coming on to discuss your own group's internal politics instead of the country's. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. And I should note, I'm not a co-founder, but I have been here a long time.
All right. And for people who don't follow the world of Washington think tanks, Cato is libertarian. We've had you and your colleagues on the show over the years to argue for free market economics, but also to argue for civil liberties that are often seen as liberal positions and against U.S. war policies. Would it be a good shorthand to say Cato is ideologically kind of like Ron Paul?
Well, I suppose kind of like, sure. We all share an interest in free markets, limited government, and non-interventionist foreign policy.
And the Koch brothers, Charles and David, are known to be more conventionally conservative, more traditionally right-wing than libertarian on most issues. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap there, but sometimes not. So what has been their role in the Cato Institute over the years?
Well, I actually think that Charles Koch, who was a co-founder of the Cato Institute, is a libertarian, at least at heart. And I think if you look at the things that he funded for many years, Cato, the Reason Foundation, some smaller organizations, they were libertarian organizations. In the past few years, he's gotten more focused on what he perceives as the need to get the Democrats out of power in Washington. That necessarily means funding groups that appear more conservative, more Republican, more partisan. So for 33 years, Charles Koch was a donor. Later, his brother became a donor to Cato. Charles served on the board for about 15 years. His brother served on the board for some years after that. Neither of them ever had any role in the direction or management of the Cato Institute other than what any single board member does. For some reason, in the past couple of years, the Kochs stopped giving money to Cato and then started using their power under this original governing document, which had been sort of kept in the attic all these years, to put people on our board who reflected not their own ideology so much as their own personal interests. Six of the seven people they've managed to place on our board are financially dependent on Koch Industries. That's not so much packing the board with conservatives, it's just packing it with people who are not independent of Koch interests.
Well, I read that their immediate interest, the Koch brothers, is to get Cato to be more partisan and less ideas-based, that is, to focus more on articulating arguments against President Obama's reelection, even though you can't officially put it in partisan terms, focus more on that than ideas on policy issues for their own sake. How much would you say that's what's going on?
Well, it's difficult to say because they haven't been transparent or forthcoming in saying what it is that all of this takeover effort, and note that it is both a lawsuit asking a court to simply give them ownership of the Cato Institute and separately using the power they already have to stack our board, though I hasten to point out they don't have a majority of the board.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been transparent about exactly what their interest is, but they did tell us in one meeting with our chairman that they would like Cato to be more helpful to their allied groups in providing studies and speakers and so on. And yes, those groups are more politically involved, more partisan, anti-Democrat, and that's not what we see as an appropriate role for an independent think tank. So there's both an ideological aspect. We don't want our libertarianism rounded off until it consists of nothing more than taxes and regulation. And second, we just don't want other groups and groups with partisan interests or any single board member telling us what to do. Cato's always been run by its board and its staff, and we think that's the appropriate way to run a think tank.
Give us some of the prehistory of the Cato Institute and your role. It was you and William Niskanen, who was the chairman who recently passed away, and I guess it was his death and the loosening of the reins of power because of his death that triggered this whole power struggle right now. But the prehistory, you and Mr. Niskanen and one or two other people who founded Cato in the early 1980s?
Well, again, I wasn't there at the founding, and neither was Bill Niskanen.
Okay.
Cato was founded by Ed Crane, who has been for 35 years the president of Cato, and by Charles Koch and by the libertarian scholar Murray Rothbard and a couple of other people back in 1977. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they set it up with this shareholder arrangement, which was supposed to be a check on the possibility of a board of directors that might divert Cato from its libertarian mission. But like I say, this shareholder arrangement just sat in a drawer in the attic. Nobody paid any attention to it for 33 years. Cato was founded in San Francisco. Cato moved to Washington in 1981, got more directly involved in public policy issues. Our budget the first year, I think, was $800,000. It grew steadily to where it's now about $20 million. We have built a building in Washington. In 1991, Charles Koch resigned from the board. There was some sort of estrangement between him and Ed Crane, the CEO. He never really clarified what his objection at that time was, but by that time his brother had joined the board, and his brother was a generous contributor. Over the last decade or so, the Kochs have given Cato about 4% of our money, and you know, nobody wants to lose donors that give them 4% of their income. But it was hardly an ownership interest or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last couple of years, something seems to have inspired Charles Koch, and maybe it is this growing interest in political activity, to start using this dormant shareholder agreement to try to take more personal control of Cato through his position as a shareholder. And yes, for the past couple of decades, there were four shareholders, two of the founders, Crane and Koch, plus David Koch and Bill Niskanen, Cato's longtime chairman. When Bill died in October, the Kochs assumed that gave them a 2-to-1 majority of the shareholder arrangement, and therefore, by definition, if you own two of the three shares of a corporation, you own it. And they moved to tell us, well, we're now in charge, and we believe that is an incorrect interpretation of the shareholder arrangement, that in fact Bill Niskanen's shares did not disappear like pixie dust. They still exist, and they are under the control of his executor, who is his widow. That is an issue a Kansas court is going to have to decide. But meanwhile, the Kochs are using what power they do have to stack our board with officers, directors, and employees of Koch Industries.
David Bowes, vice president of the Cato Institute, talking about the power struggle within that organization. And what do you think this conflict tells us generally about the relationship between money and the ideas we debate in the public square in this country is? Do wealthy donors who pump money into think tanks disproportionately get to shape the public debate through the think tanks, setting policy priorities and releasing papers on those topics of interest to them?
No, generally, I don't think they do. Cato had this ridiculous shareholder arrangement that very few other groups do. It's not unprecedented among nonprofits, but it's unusual. And nobody even seems to know why we have it, except it was Charles Koch's idea in 1977, and that may tell us what he had in mind from the beginning. I think if you look at most think tanks, including Cato, of course they get support from wealthy people. That's how they exist. But the staffs are usually pretty firm about their own independence. Now, there are other groups in Washington that you know, super PACs and particular special interest groups that do, I think, represent the ideas of particular big donors. And, of course, the big donors vary widely. There's Sheldon Adelson, who cares a lot about Israel. There's George Soros, who has very different views from the Kochs. There are Christian right donors who have different views from George Soros or Charles Koch. So one of the things we get by having privately funded think tanks is robust dialogue, even if they are representing the views of the donors. My experience is donors give you money because they like what you do. They don't give you money expecting you will then do what they like. So we go out and we tell people what we do, and we try to find wealthy people and non-wealthy people. I mean, we have 15,000 donors. They're not all rich, but obviously the larger donations are more helpful. I think we have more individual donors than, say, the Brookings Institution does. We don't have as many as the Heritage Foundation does, and that reflects a different level of sort of concentration of donations versus widespread direct mail kind of fundraising.
That's all interesting. And I think yet there's a question about what a think tank is versus maybe what people think that it is. If there's no difference between a think tank and a PAC, then something has changed. Because if a PAC is just a special interest organization representing individuals who have their own interest in some of the ways you just described, or, you know, particular points of view that are out there, a think tank supposedly thinks.
Well, that's right, I'm certainly not saying that there's no difference between a think tank and a PAC. I think if you look at the Brookings Institution, the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, you're getting a variety of different opinions that are not directed by funders in any of those cases. Ed Fulner is a pretty strong CEO over at Heritage. Brookings has a long history of strong-minded, thoughtful scholars who I'm sure don't take orders from the very large funders that they have. So I think that is different from groups that are started particularly for an ideological purpose or are advancing a particular interest, whether it is getting tough on the Arabs or supporting the American farm or environmentalism. Obviously, there are environmental groups that are supported by very wealthy people who agree with their environmental agenda. And that is part of the robust American political debate. And we do, in fact, have rich people on a variety of sides of issues. But I do think think tanks, at least the ones that you think of when you say think tank. Now, there are a lot of groups in Washington that are under the 501c3 tax code that probably don't fall into the same category as Brookings, AEI, and Cato.
So for yourself, before you go, and we're almost out of time, have your views evolved on things over the years in a, you know, some very shorthand way that you identify? Because watching the Ron Paul campaign, for example, it seems that his hasn't. He's saying the same things that he was saying when he ran for president in 1976, except applying them to contemporary details. There can be something a little sclerotic about a pure ideology that doesn't change with national circumstances. Maybe we have to ask ourselves different questions or come up with different answers after a 9/11, after a housing crash, whatever. If a think tank, Cato or any other, is devoted to an ideology like libertarianism, what does that say about its ability to think?
Well, I think it says that we look at things from the perspective of believing that people make better decisions than other people can make for them, that peace is better than war, that competition is better than centralization. That doesn't tell you the exact solution in every case. And if you come to something like a Cato monetary conference, we do a conference every year on monetary policy, you'll hear some pretty heated debate about exactly how to achieve the goals of sound money and a stable economy, but these fundamental principles, I think, are still there. And the fundamental principles that Thomas Jefferson believed, I think, are applicable to Egypt and Iceland today, but that doesn't mean the specific manifestation is going to be the same.
David Bowes, vice president of the Cato Institute, now embroiled in a power struggle between the Koch brothers and other members of their board over what the mission of the organization will be, apparently, and what the ideology of the organization will be. David Bowes, thank you very much for talking with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, what happens when a country urbanizes at a shockingly fast pace? And I mean quicker than anything you can imagine in U.S. history. We'll look at the millions of people that that's affecting in China's great migration. Stay with us.